Before I start the chapter, this opening chapter, let me say that I'm not a notes cop. I'm not going to demand that you do something a certain way. But I will tell you at least what I think is best for most students, and that is to take old-fashioned notes, which means a blank piece of paper, not writing in the margins of printout of the slideshow or anything like that.
I got cues.
Whatever helps you is right, but I think it's best to just put it down on paper. It's important, though, going back to what I was saying about refining your notes at home with the recordings, it's important to be able to edit these later, to add information to them slide by slide. So it's important to keep track of where you are slide-wise in your notes. You should draw a line each time I switch slides and write the slide number, which is always this red number in the lower right, which I'll always try to announce on the recordings. The opening chapter that we're looking at a slide of is also part of this exceptionality of day one, because this is not a normal chapter in a sense. It's a kind of a catch-all overview of biology. All the rest of the chapters are focused on a topic. But biology, hopefully you already know, is the study of life. And so it's important to know what life is. It's one of those things that you can recognize when you see it more easily than you can say what it is. It doesn't have a clear-cut definition, really. But there are living things, obviously. You already know that. Living things, by the way, make up one category of objects in the universe. There's three major categories, of which one is living things. With that in mind, what do you think are the other two categories?
Non-living things.
Right, that's another category. Now, those two, logically speaking, seems like they would be exhaustive. Seems like there would be nothing else besides those two, right? Living and non-living. It must be one of the two. There's actually a third category. Which is what? What are you if you are not living and you are not non-living?
Nothing.
No, I'm talking about objects, actual material. Dead, exactly. Dead things and non-living things are not the same thing, right? A dead thing was a living thing, isn't anymore. A non-living thing never was living to begin with. A rock is a non-living thing. A corpse is a dead thing. You are a living thing. But what makes you living? Well, first of all, another word for a living thing is an organism. And all organisms share certain things. So rather than giving a short dictionary definition of what an organism is, we really do what this slide is indicating, which is recognize that all organisms, despite a huge variety of organisms, share these seven major features. Now, some of these also can be shared by non-living things, but not all seven of them. All right? Back to organisms for a second, though. An organism is another word for a living thing, like I said. What is what is the strict requirement, structurally speaking, for being an organism? I mean, obviously we are organisms, right? What about a bacterium? Is it an organism?
Yeah.
I agree with that. A virus?
Maybe.
Well, that's a cop-out, because it's one or the other. There's no maybe category allowed. Do you think that a virus is an organism?
Yeah.
It's not an organism. A virus is not alive. Despite the fact that I see, especially because of the pandemic, commercials all the time saying, kills a virus. A product will kill the virus. Well, you can't kill something that's not alive to begin with. Yes, it would be better to say that the virus is inactivated. But a virus is not an organism. It does not have life, because life, really, when you get down to it, and we'll talk much more about this in coming lectures, life is really just chemistry. And it's specifically the chemistry that happens inside little test tubes, more or less, called cells. The sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in an organism is called metabolism. Organisms are living only if they have a metabolism. That's why when something is dead, that's what distinguishes it from a living thing. It's no longer living because it's no longer metabolizing. These chemical reactions that really are life won't happen properly unless they are sequestered away from the rest of the universe. That's why I called cells test tubes earlier. If you think about a glass test tube, the reason you use that is so that you can conduct a little bit of a chemistry, whatever chemistry is going on inside the test tube, away from the rest of the surroundings. And that's what cells do. There's a barrier, the plasma membrane, that separates the interior of the cell from the exterior of the cell, everything else in the universe. Well, a virus doesn't come close to having that. A virus is really just a couple molecules. And it's reasonable for people to think they are alive. For one thing, they're told they're alive fictionally by commercials. But it's reasonable to think that because obviously viruses interact with organisms. We're still in an epidemic, a viral epidemic. Obviously, they affect organisms, but they themselves are not alive. They are just molecules that, because of the nature of those molecules, cause things to happen in our cells differently. Our meaning organisms' cells. Okay, so only organisms have all seven of these properties. Let's go through these clockwise, starting with response to the environment. Well, I don't think that any of these is going to surprise you, just because you've experienced your lives up to this point. You know already that organisms respond to their environment. Obviously, you do. We are multicellular organisms, which is just a structural definition. There's kind of a dichotomy as far as structure of organisms is concerned. A dichotomy is a two-part thing. Structurally speaking, there are two major categories of organisms. There are unicellular organisms and there are multicellular organisms. We are multicellular organisms. But to be an organism, structurally speaking, the strict requirement is that you have at least one cell. A virus doesn't have a cell. Right? But that means even unicellular organisms, like bacteria, for instance, are full-blown organisms. They're just smaller and less complex in terms of number of cells. But they still have a metabolism happening inside that cell. And even bacteria respond to their environment. Doesn't take a very structurally complex organism for that to happen. Organisms have to respond to their environment in order to stay alive. If they don't, they're no longer a living organism. Okay, reproduction. This one you already are familiar with too, I'm sure. By the way, reproduction is not a requirement to be an organism. For instance, I have chosen not to procreate, but that doesn't make me cease to be an organism. I'm still an organism. What reproduction here refers to is that species have the capacity to reproduce, even though not all of those individuals will. This, by the way, reproduction is an example of one of these things I was talking about earlier that can be true of certain non-living things as well. Crystals, for instance, can reproduce even though they are not living. But living things have the ability to reproduce themselves. Now, cells, by the way, before we get too far through this, do you have a feel for how multicellular you are? What I mean is, you have Do you have any idea how many cells make up a typical adult human? It's a hell of a big number, because cells are microscopically small. Right. Roughly 100 trillion cells make up just one human. Depends on the human, of course, because there are different sized humans, but it's a good average. So that means, you know, a trillion is a million, right? A billion is 1,000 million. So a million cells, a million seems like a big number, and it is in some respects, but a million cells is still tiny. It's a tiny fraction of your body. There's a million red blood cells in a little volume of blood the size of a pinhead. So trillions of cells. And by the way, there's even more. The 100 trillion cells that make up you are really vastly outnumbered by bacteria that live in and on you. For every one of your own cells, there are between 10 and 100 bacterial cells that live in and on you. But I mentioned this because cells is the focus of the course in general. We're going to spend the whole term in the cell. And I just want to give you an idea of how small they are. Let's go to growth and development. Two different things listed in one category, even though they are distinct from each other. Now, growth, of course, refers to getting bigger. But this applies to both multicellular and unicellular organisms, like all of these do. So obviously, multicellular organisms like yourself grow. Well, you all started out as one cell, the zygote created by the fertilization that started your life officially, even though that is really a continuation of billions of years of cells. But officially, you began as a zygote. That's one cell. You're no longer one cell. Multicellular organisms get big by adding more and more cells. But that's, of course, growth. But even a single cell grows. And that should make some sense if you think about it. A bacterium is an example of a unicellular organism. From our point of view, it has a pretty short lifespan, about 20 minutes from the time it's its own cell to when it will end its life and become two new cells. It's unlike us, where the parent usually survives the reproduction process. When a bacterium splits into two new cells, that original bacterium is no longer there. It's replaced by two progeny cells. But what should make sense to you is that obviously at that very moment that the splitting happens, those two cells can't be both full-sized cells, right? They're roughly half the size of the original cell. So even a single cell has to grow a certain amount. Development refers to changes that happen along the way. And for instance, using your own body as an example, not only are you no longer a zygote, a single cell, but you're also not simply 100 trillion copies of that zygote. You're not just a huge mass of identical cells. Your body contains all kinds of different sorts of cells, right? Neurons are fundamentally different from muscle cells or from bone cells. They all have the same DNA, except your red blood cells have no DNA anymore. But they have specialized. That's part of development. Energy processing is something that all organisms have to do. There's a continuous exchange of energy between an organism and its surroundings if it has any hope of remaining alive. And there will be an entire unit, Unit 3, devoted to energy processing. So we'll talk a lot more about that. Regulation refers to keeping variables within tolerable limits. So to remain alive, things like temperature cannot get too high or too low because it would be lethal. And there's all kinds of variables. Temperature is just one of them. But that's what regulation is about. And this brings up the notion of homeostasis, which is a word that means staying the same even though that's really a lie. Homeostasis does not really result in organisms staying the same. Any cell is continuously changing, just like the room temperature is continuously changing. It's almost never exactly where you set it with the thermostat, right? It's usually a little bit above or a little bit below. But it doesn't get too high or too low because it's regulated. And similarly with various variables, temperature is just one of them in organisms. So we'll talk about how that occurs later. Then we have a high degree of order. Now in some organisms it's more obvious than others. Like this is obviously a very highly ordered middle of a flower. But all organisms, unicellular organisms, multicellular organisms, exhibit a high degree of order when you get down to the microscopic details of it. And by the way, that order is not something that is free. It takes a lot of energy to actually maintain that order, which is why the order will not still be there after death. And then the top one here, the final one, is evolutionary adaptation, which is a phrase for which both of these words are important. We should talk about them individually. To evolve is just generally speaking, not within biology. It simply means to change. And evolution is a hugely important biological topic, but it's more of a 182 topic, so you'll study it in much more detail there. I just want to talk about it a little bit here. Evolution does not refer to an individual. Individuals don't evolve. Populations of individuals evolve between generations. So the changes that occur aren't occurring within an individual's life. They're occurring when you compare one population to its descendants. The descendants will be different from the previous generation. That's evolution. And if I were to just randomly poll the public about who is famous for evolution, what would the answer be?
Darwin.
Darwin, even though Charles Darwin did not come up with the idea of evolution. There were many people before Darwin who talked about the possibility of evolution, which was controversial back then because everyone believed that organisms were made a certain way and they never change. He was not the first to talk about evolution. So that's not really what he's famous for, even though that's what it seems like he's famous for. Instead, he's famous for being the first to come up with a scientific explanation for how evolution happens. Natural selection. That's what he's famous for. Natural selection is the mechanism that he figured out by which evolution happens. And in 182, you'll learn that actually there are more ways that evolution can happen than just natural selection. But natural selection is the only way that evolution can happen in a way that leads to greater and greater fitness. And that's what the adaptation part of the phrase refers to. Adapt as a word by itself simply means making a change so that there is a better fit, right? Well, to adapt evolutionarily means that the next generation is changed in such a way that they are better able to live in their surroundings than their previous generation was. And that's because of natural selection. All right, I'll talk a little bit more about natural selection later on, so I won't get into that right now. But those are seven major characteristics of living things. And not all of these slides take that long, by the way. Slide 2 gives you a pictorial representation of a hierarchy, which just in general, a hierarchy is a nested arrangement of things. Meaning one group contains a number of smaller groups, each of those contain a number of smaller groups, and so on. It's nested. Well, the hierarchy we're looking at here is the hierarchy of biological organization. And I'm going to go through this from small to big. So I'll start out with the lower right-hand edge. Now, this is not, we see atoms here. That's the smallest level we're looking at here. Atoms are not the smallest things in the universe. So this is not the smallest possible thing in a hierarchy that you could think about. Because even smaller things, as inconceivably tiny as an atom is, and there are many, many millions of atoms in just one of your 100 trillion cells, each of which you can't even see. So atoms are truly, truly tiny. But as tiny as they are, they're made of even smaller things. They're not included in the hierarchy of biological organization, though, because even though they are important, they're really not part of biology. When you get below the level of the atom, you're physics and chemistry, exactly. So we'll start with atoms, and we'll be describing atoms a lot more in a different lecture. But that's your simple level. And by the way, something about this biological hierarchy is that it features what is called emergent properties. Now, to emerge means to come out from hiding, right? To make yourself seen. Emergent properties refers to the fact that as you go from one level in this hierarchy to the next higher level, that next higher level will feature some things, some properties that the lower levels don't feature. And just to give you an example using atoms and molecules, which is the next level up. Atoms, well, first of all, let me explain the difference between the two levels. Atoms is their own level. Atoms of different kinds can combine to form more complex structures called molecules. That's the next level up in the hierarchy. And to use a familiar example, if you get two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom together, it forms a molecule of water. Well, that's the emergent properties that I'm talking about, an example here, is that water has properties that neither of the atoms that make it up by themselves have. Okay, so it's the property of the next level only, not the lower levels. Okay, so molecules, even though it's lower on the screen, it's the second level. Molecules, then, of different types combine into more complex structures called organelles, which is a word that linguistically means little organ, because they are like organs within a cell compared to organs within our body. But they are subcellular, meaning smaller than the cell. All of these first three levels are subcellular, smaller than the cell. So even though this is a hierarchy of life, none of these is by themselves living. All right? But organelles are things that you probably have studied a little bit in high school, things like mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum. We're going to go through all of that in this course eventually. Those are organelles, though. Smaller than a cell. Organelles of different types make up more complex structures called cells, the next level. And now finally we're at life, because like I told you earlier, to be a living organism requires that you have at least one cell. And here's a little bit of a, I don't think it's too confusing, but I should mention it, that we're going to go through a couple, three more levels above cell that actually only apply to multicellular organisms. Eventually, we'll get to organism level, which is one individual. Well, for a unicellular organism, the cell and the organism is really the same thing, right? So these next few levels apply only to things like us, multicellular organisms. Anyway, cells of different types get together to form more complex structures called tissues. And what those tissues are depend on what kind of organism you are. Plants have certain tissues. We animals have certain tissues. For instance, your body is made out of four types of tissue: epithelial tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue, and muscle tissue. Different names for the tissues in plants and other multicellular organisms, but that's what tissues are. Tissues of different sorts then get together into more complex things called organs, which is by itself one level. And you're familiar with your organs, right? The skin is an organ, the lung is an organ, and so on. An organ, though, is a set of tissues that perform a specific function, like the lung does. Yeah.
So when you're talking about order in the previous slide,
yeah.
This
is just part of order, exactly. Yes, that's just one facet of order, but it's an important one. Okay, so organs is its own level. Well, even though there are different organs, you can have different organs cooperating for a common function. And therefore, the next level is an organ system. There are 11 for humans, for instance. Reproductive system, circulatory system, and so on. Each one is multiple organs cooperating for a common function. So this is listed together, but that's two separate levels, organ level and organ system level. And then you finally get to the organism level, which, like I said before, if you're a unicellular organism, you don't have these in between. Cell and organism are the same thing, but for us, they're different levels. All right, well, the organism level, I mean, actually the cell level is where we're going to stay the whole term, except for this discussion for this slide. All the rest of these levels are important in Bio 182. But we don't stop at organism. Next step up is populations. And a population is all of the organisms of the same species living in a specific place. So, for instance, you can talk about the population of ants somewhere, certain species of ants. That's a population.
Population of ants on this campus.
Yes, exactly. But one kind of ant.
Yeah.
Now, next step up is community. And the difference between the two, it's the same space, but in a population, that's one species in that space. When you consider all of the species that are living in that same space, then it's the community that you're looking at, not a single population. Okay, so the same space, just you're including more things in it. Now, what's the difference then between a community and the next step up, which is an ecosystem? It is, once again, the same space, by the way. Yeah.
Communities are like multiple organisms, and an ecosystem is like when they rely on each other. For example, like let's say the ant dies, like the ant eater eats the ant eater, then something else eats the ant eater, and when it dies, it helps the soil grow, and then the trees grow from it.
You could say about community, though, as well. Because what you were describing in all of that was organisms, right, in an area, which is what a community is. So the fundamental difference between a community and an ecosystem is that the community is all of the organisms in that place, but that's it. The ecosystem is all of the organisms, which are living things and dead things, plus all of the non-living things there. So the water and the rocks and all the other non-living things are included in the ecosystem. They're not part of the community. You see the difference? Well, that leaves only one step up, which is the biosphere, which is all known life. And it's called the biosphere because, at least for now, the only thing that we can say with definitive proof that is alive is earthbound, and Earth itself is a sphere. But the biosphere is only as big as it needs to be to include all the known organisms. So it's not the entire planet. It's spherical in shape, but it's a hollow sphere with a thickness to its wall. And the thickness of that wall actually keeps growing because we keep finding more things that we didn't realize could exist in places, like deeper in underground or farther out into the atmosphere. But the extents of the thickness of the biosphere are how deep you can go and still find living things and how far away from the surface you can go and still find living things. So it's a hollow sphere. Spherical shaped for what we know. But it's almost certain. I mean, it's kind of foolish to think that the only life exists here just because of the numbers involved. So it's almost certain that there's a hell of a lot of life out there. But the distances between things are so immense that it's also very probable that we'll never come into contact with any of it. And you can't just, in science at least, say, well, this has to be true. You can't do that. You have to demonstrate in science. So until we actually have proof that there's life elsewhere, the biosphere will be just that big. The minute we do have proof, if it ever comes, then the biosphere will get a lot bigger and it will no longer be spherical shaped. But that's the biggest level in the hierarchy. All right, let's go to 3. Here we have a photograph that represents an ecosystem like I just described in the previous slide. It doesn't matter what this specific example is. It could be just about any ecosystem at the surface of the Earth. The important point is not the specific ecosystem. It's that for any given ecosystem, there is a throughput of energy as opposed to material. A throughput means that energy enters and then it eventually leaves the ecosystem. It goes through the ecosystem. You can see energy coming in as sunlight. It's an example of energy. Well, it doesn't stay as sunlight once it enters the ecosystem. That energy gets transformed and transferred. It's no longer sunlight, but it's other forms of energy. Bounces around between not only organisms, but also non-living things. So it goes through a lot of transformation and transference. But it eventually leaves as heat. So energy comes in, it goes out. Materials, on the other hand, things that are made of matter, not perfectly, but more or less stay within the ecosystem. There is some leakage. And that's kind of shown with these arrows involving these molecules. CO2 and O2 are just two of thousands and thousands of different kinds of molecules in any given ecosystem. So the atoms that make up these molecules aren't always in that molecule. They're going to be parts of other molecules as chemicals get transformed as well. But those atoms were there to begin with, and they'll still be there in the ecosystem because materials are recycled as opposed to energy. You can see that a little bit more in slide 4, which is kind of a continuation of that slide. Sunlight's coming in again, yellow arrow. Doesn't show you that all the transformations that occur, but one transformation that occurs is that the sunlight gets captured by photosynthetic organisms, which produce organic compounds, food for itself. The plant is not trying to feed this primate. The primate is just taking advantage of the fact that the plant has made its own food. And so that's the energy that used to be in the sunlight is now captured in the molecules that the plants produce. That's a transformation of energy. Eventually, though, it leaves as heat. The energy does. By the way, the eating of plants brings up an ecological definition that is also an important 182 topic. But ecologically speaking, there are two major kinds of organisms. And those are producers and consumers. Producers have the ability to feed themselves. Photosynthetic organisms are one type of producer. They're not the only producers, but they're the majority of producers. And we're used to thinking of plants, but plants did not invent photosynthesis. It existed long before there were plants. Like almost all the important biochemical pathways, they were invented before anything else existed by bacteria, the most successful organisms in history. And that'll probably always be the case. But anyway, photosynthesis is conducted by producers. They capture energy to make their own food. Well, consumers can't do this. So consumers absolutely can't exist without the producers. A consumer is anything that relies on a producer, basically. A consumer can eat a producer, or a consumer can eat a consumer that eats a producer, or a consumer can eat a consumer that eats a producer, but it has to always go back to the producer. consumers can't live in isolation. That is a correct clock, unusually. That'll bring us to five. And here we have, I probably won't get all the way through this slide because we're almost done, but this example of bird bones is an example of something that's important in biology, which is a correspondence between form and function. And this brings back up natural selection. Because of natural selection, things in organisms have the structure or the form that they do because that structure happens to function well in that organism's lifestyle. Now, that happens kind of randomly, but the randomness is constrained and refined by natural selection over generations. And that's why we say that the population has evolved, because each successive generation gets a little bit better at doing its living in those in that situation. Well, birds fly, and that flight, of course, would be much more difficult if they weighed a lot, right? So birds have to be light, but they can't be very fragile either. A lot of people like to think of birds as fragile, but they're not all that fragile. Flapping wings exerts a hell of a lot of forces on the skeleton. If they were as fragile as people imagine birds are, there would be no birds that could survive flight. It would just snap their bones. So they're made strong despite being light. They are pneumatized, which means air-filled, like in pneumatic, meaning air-driven. They're hollow bones. Now, let me try to quickly explain this in the remaining couple minutes. Natural selection is not a design process. It just refines accidents that happen. Design is intentional. Like if you're an engineer, for instance, you design something for a specific purpose. So that's not how biology works, but let's think about design for a second. If I say you have a certain mass of material to use in your project, you can't go over that, what I'm getting at by analogy is that a bird can only be so heavy, right? So it's constrained by how massive it can be. So if I give you the project of you have exactly this much material to work with and you need to make a strong structure, well, you could make rods, right? Solid cylinders. And the problem with that is that since they're solid, you would use up all of your mass pretty quickly, right? And therefore, the diameter of the rod would have to be pretty small because you would run out of material. And therefore, since that rod is very thin, it would be easy to bend it. You know, think about a thin wire, easy to bend because of that thinness. If instead, though, you take the same amount of material and make a bigger diameter, hollow cylinder, you've used the same amount of mass, but you have a much greater diameter. And if you look at newly fashioned bikes compared to old fashioned bikes, that's exactly what you see. Bigger tubes that weigh less but are much stronger than smaller diameter ones. And the reason they are stronger is if you try to bend this rod, or you try to bend either cylinder, by bending it to some angle, you're going to have to compress one side of it and expand the other side, right? You see what I'm saying there? Well, as the diameter increases, for the same angle of bending, there's going to be greater amount of compression required, and a greater amount of expansion required, and therefore it's going to resist that bending. So large diameter tubes are much stronger than a rod made out of the same amount of stuff. And that's what natural selection has done. You know, by accidentally having different versions in different individuals because of genetic mutation, the ones that just happened to have the characteristic of having bigger diameter bones were favored because they survived longer. That's what natural selection is. So they passed on the genes for wider bones to the next generation, and it got better and better. That's how evolution happens. All right, I'll stop there. I'll see you downstairs.